Well, rather famously, these visits that Oswald made to the Cuban consulate and Russian embassy did not get recorded. There are no pictures in existence of Oswald making these visits. Wynn Scott reportedly did have pictures of Oswald down there and supposedly some audio tapes. When he passed away a few years after the assassination, who shows up down in Mexico City to take all of his evidence into custody but James Angleton, and the data then disappears?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, Wynn Scott had that Cuban consulate very carefully watched. And so they had an impulse camera on the door that Oswald walked in and out of at least three times. And that camera was supposed to take a picture of whoever entered and whoever left. And two CIA officers did later say that Wynn Scott had showed them surveillance photos of Oswald. But no such photos have ever surfaced. So we also know that the CIA story that Oswald's visits took place on the weekend was not true, that the camera was not working, that was not true either. So that surveillance was very tight. And that's one thing that Wynn Scott said in his memoir was, we did not miss Oswald visiting the Cubans, which was a lie that the CIA had told the Warren Commission, that the CIA didn't know Oswald had been in touch with the Cubans until after the assassination. That wasn't true, and Wynn Scott knew it wasn't true, and he said it wasn't true in his manuscript. And when he died, as you said, Angleton went down there, snatched the manuscript and all the material that was in his office. So I think there probably were recordings and perhaps photographs of Oswald in Wynn Scott's possession, but if so, they are in CIA possession now or they were destroyed.
Well, the thing that James Angleton is perhaps best known to history for is his mole hunt in the CIA as head of counterintelligence. You note in the book that Angleton's old buddy, his OSS trainer, in fact, Kim Philby, rather notoriously turned out to have been a Soviet spy in the 60s and then showed up in Moscow. A lot of folks have attributed the psychic damage done to Angleton for his later actions, which led to his downfall. Can you talk a bit about all of this?
This is a part of the Angleton story that is well known and one which certainly I came to believe in very much. That Kim Philby's betrayal of James Angleton was a huge psychological blow and a decisive and formative chapter in his CIA career after 1963, when Philby's betrayal became known to the world. Counterintelligence is by its very nature, is a kind of paranoid profession, right? In intelligence, you're trying to steal the other guy's secrets. In counterintelligence, you're trying to prevent him from doing that to you, right? So it's the flip side of intelligence work, and it's very important. And this was part of Angleton's genius. I mean, he had this insight about the importance of counterintelligence work. Maybe he even exaggerated its importance, but he understood theoretically how important it was in the great game of espionage to be protecting yourself. The enemy is not going to tell you when he's trying to penetrate you. You have to, you know, read incomplete information, deceptive information. So it's a paranoid profession. Well, then on top of that, you have this personal reality that the man who taught you the counterintelligence profession, Kim Philby, was in fact a spy himself. So that made him even more paranoid. And then you layer on another thing, which was the prodigious drinking that these guys did, you know, in the 50s and 60s, the heyday of the three martini lunch. And Angleton was an alcoholic in the later part of his career. Even his friends don't deny that. And one of the symptoms of chronic alcoholism is paranoia.
Sure.
So he's in a paranoid profession. He's had a personal relationship which has ended in betrayal, which made him more paranoid. And he's got a drinking problem, which added to that. So all of those things together really shaped his life in the later part of his career and really, in some sense, drove him crazy and eventually caused his CIA colleagues to say, you know, his usefulness is over and he needs to leave the agency. And so eventually CIA Director Bill Colby fires him for a whole bunch of reasons. But it was, I think it's fair to say that a lot of his problems go back to the betrayal of Kim Philby.
There's another part of Angleton's legacy that's not insignificant, worthy of mention. I think during his last years in power, Angleton sort of looks the other way while Israel obtains an atomic bomb.
Yeah, This is another important part of The Ghost, and I advanced the story a little bit. It has been told before about how Israeli agents obtained a couple hundred kilos of fissile material from a nuclear processing plant in Pennsylvania and used it to build their own bombs, their own atomic bombs. Israel had the technological know-how by the mid-1960s to build a bomb. What they didn't have was fissile material, and they apparently got it from this company in Pennsylvania between 1964 and 1968 when they finally had their first nuclear weapon. Engelton was the Israeli desk officer for the CIA at the time, so he had a responsibility for reporting on Israeli activities, both the development of the nuclear program in Israel and the loss of fissile material in the United States. Those were both matters that were part of Engelton's formal job responsibilities. And as well, Engelton, because of his good friendships with Israelis, he was personal friends with six men who were witting to the secret Israel's secret nuclear program. And he reported, you know, basically none of that, as far as we know, to the CIA, and obfuscated the path when people started asking questions about it later in the 1970s. And in fact, most of the CIA records on the whole issue remain secret to this day. This is looks to be Engelton proceeding by omission, not commission. His fingerprints do not appear on the diversion of fissile material, but it happened on his watch when he had responsibility for reporting such things. And there's no indication that he reported anything of what he knew about the secret Israeli nuclear program. So that's part of his record now. And what I found was one additional piece of the story, which was the private conclusions of a man who had worked for Engelton for 7 years, John Haddon, who had served first as station chief in Tel Aviv and then as an assistant to Engelton in Washington, but always with responsibility for Israeli intelligence. And John Haddon, in retirement, wrote up a memo which he shared only with senior government officials with the proper clearances about how the Israelis had stolen this material and why he had come to that conclusion. Haddon is dead, but his son shared with me some of his private papers, and in the papers he explains why the diversion took place. And he doesn't mention Angleton's name, but it's very clear that that's what he's talking about, and that's what he wanted to set straight. And John Haddon said Engelton had no interest in that, and I knew better than to report anything because he wasn't going to do anything about it because he was so close to the Israelis. So that's a story that's out there, and I strengthened it a little bit and added some more detail by bringing forward the account of John Haddon.
Well, all of what you've written about has taken years of digging, and of course there's a great deal more we still do not know. And I think a lot of people think that without a doubt there's going to be things of interest in the JFK assassination-related documents that are being held in the archives still. This has been in the news of late. They did not release what they were supposed to. I guess the question I would have is, what would you like to see released among those documents relative to Engelton and others?
First of all, there was a release the other day which was welcome about the surveillance of Oswald, and it's about how Oswald's name was put on a list of 300 Americans to have their mail opened. This is before the assassination. So that list was called a watch list, and that list was compiled by Engelton's office. So when Oswald's name was put on there, we can be sure that that had Engelton's approval. And this happened well before the Kennedy assassination. So that's an indication of how interested they were in him. They put him on the list. They had some reason to put him on the list. Then they took him off the list, and then they put him back on the list. So, you know, they were thinking about this guy, and they were making decisions accordingly. So we've already got a little piece of information from the latest releases about that. But there is other Engelton material that has not been released. Most notably, Engelton gave a closed-door testimony to the Church Committee in 1975, talked to them for 2 or 3 hours. It's a 155-page transcript, which has not been released yet. So that's very telling that I think that it hasn't been released yet, and that's the kind of thing that I'm looking to see, be released in the coming months.
Well, as you mentioned, he was quite persuasive on an individual level. I note that in retirement, he was still working with journalists. And you can see on the internet, there's a BBC special where he's criticizing CIA leadership, the people that fired him. Hints darkly at Soviet plots. He worked with a man named Edward Epstein to float this the Soviets ran Oswald theory. I guess up to the end, he was still doing intelligence work.
Talk about conspiracy theorists. I mean, he was the king of them. He had a conspiracy theory for everything. He spun a lot of, you know, KGB conspiracy theories to Ed Epstein and other people. And these theories were, you know, they were persuasive to some people. But what's interesting is, you know, the point of a central intelligence agency is to develop usable intelligence for the government, right? I mean, it's almost self-evident. So if Angleton thought that there had been a conspiracy of a hostile foreign intelligence service to kill the president of the United States, it was his duty, it was his job to write those concerns down and investigate them. So Angleton served as counterintelligence for 11 years after Kennedy's assassination. And if you go to look for it, so what did the counterintelligence staff prepare in terms of memoranda, analysis, reports? What kind of evidence did they collect? How did they assess this theory? All that. There is literally nothing there, Doug. There's nothing there. He did not write down a single one of these theories. He did not investigate them. So when I hear conspiracy theories like that have no evidence, that have no analysis behind them, they're simply not credible.
Sure.
And so I dismiss Angleton's KGB conspiracy theory because it's not documented. He never documented it. Now, other people came along and said, well, maybe this is true and maybe that. But the point is, it was his job to document. It's not some journalist's job to say whether that happened or not. And he didn't do it. So that, to me, suggests that he was not operating in good faith around questions of the JFK conspiracy. Because if he did believe what he said, he would have done something, and he didn't. So I don't think he was operating in good faith when he spun JFK conspiracy theories. I think his JFK conspiracy theories, like 99% of the JFK conspiracy theories out there, is useless, and there's no need to pay attention to it.
I guess my final question is, how would you summarize Angleton's legacy?
I want to be fair. His insight about the importance of counterintelligence work is undeniable. It is also undeniable that the CIA at that time underestimated the KGB. I talked to one CIA veteran who said something very interesting to me. He said the KGB was probably the better intelligence service, more professionally run, more effective, but they were working for a government that was less strong than the CIA. The CIA was the inferior intelligence service, but it was working for a superior government, a government that was stronger, had more legitimacy, and would last longer. The KGB was a strong intelligence service, but they were working for a weak state, the communist state, which was founded on or run on repression and did not have the ability to sustain itself. So Angleton had real insights into the KGB and the Cold War power struggle, that's for sure. But he operated with total secrecy. No accountability. He made lots of mistakes. And because he was so secret and so powerful, he was never held accountable. And so he had this vast and sometimes malign influence on U.S. policy in many different areas that nobody in the government even knew about it. I think that after Angleton was fired, people in the CIA themselves were extremely worried, like, what has this guy been doing in our name? And we don't have answers to that, especially around the JFK story. We don't have a good explanation of Angleton's, what he was doing with Oswald. What was the nature of that interest? Was he manipulating Oswald? I mean, based on what we now know, that's an extremely fair question to ask. It's not a conspiracy theory. If you look at the record, it's like, what the hell was going on
right here?
And that's, you know, that's my bottom line is Angleton was a brilliant guy. He was deceptive, he was ambitious, and he may have been quite sinister, you know, and we're left to grapple with that possibility and the hope that, you know, maybe we'll get some more insight into that from further declassification.
The book is titled The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Angleton. We've been speaking with its author, Jefferson Morley. This is a fascinating read. I want to assure listeners that we've not done it justice in a brief chat like this. There's so many fascinating subplots in it. We really suggest you go out and get the book. And but before you go, Jeff, can you mention some of your websites, including JFK Facts? I know you put a lot of work into those, and there, it's a repository of some great great sources of data.
JFK Facts is a blog that I've run for 5 years about the JFK assassination, and the idea is to live up to the name, which is to study the assassination from a factual basis, assess what are true facts, what are real facts, eliminate bad information, bad stories, bad sources, so that we can, you know, focus and understand this question a little bit better, and also address it in a little more dispassionate way. I mean, we see the intense interest in, you know, new JFK files, and the press comes running, and everybody wants to know, is there a smoking gun and all that? Well, what's that about? That's about, you know, this incident still fascinates us and disturbs us, and people still want to know, they still want a better explanation of what we have. So at JFK Facts, I try and, you know, stay on the cutting edge of what's new, what's reliable, and what can we say. So it's a good place for people to keep up with the story of the JFK files releases.
Well, Jeff Zamorley, we suggest that you keep up the great work. We're great admirers of what you've done. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Doug.
All right. For nearly two decades, Chris Hedges was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times and other publications. Mr. Hedges was, in fact, part of a team at the Times which won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. Chris Hedges began as a freelance correspondent from Latin America during the dictatorships in Argentina and Chile. He has covered war in El Salvador and later the Balkans, before becoming New York Times Mideast bureau chief. Chris Hedges is a minister's son, a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School, and author of three previous books on religion and war. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and teaches in the Program for American Studies at Princeton University. His current book expands upon that 2004 essay. It's titled American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. It is a review of the cultural battleground, which has been raging for decades, and outlines in clear language what the Christian right's goals are for America and why we need to fight back. He's been on our short list of desired guests for some time. We're pleased to have him join us today. Chris Hedges, welcome to Radio Parallax.
Thank you.
The juxtaposition of the term fascists with American is no doubt jarring to many people. Can you start by defining how that term we associate with Hitler and Mussolini indeed applies to many in the Christian right in this country?
Well, you're right. It has historical connotations. It's a word that's probably been thrown around a little too loosely. But I think when you look generically at what it is that makes up the Christian right, what it is they believe, and you place that against the belief systems of traditional fascist movements, many things square up. And I actually begin the book by quoting a small section written by Umberto Eco in his own book, Five Moral Pieces, called Eternal Fascism, 14 Ways of Looking at a Black Shirt, in which he describes what he thinks are the 14 most important characteristics of a fascist movement, which, of course, can exist in any democratic society. So this is a book that really tries to make the case that rather than a religious movement, the radical Christian right in this country is a mass political movement that bears within it the seeds of a religious fascism and has many characteristics of classical fascist movements.
Well, you start out early in the book with a quote from Joseph Goebbels, the information minister of the German Nazi Party, which I'd like to quote at this point. You noted that he wrote, "The best propaganda is that which works invisibly, penetrates the whole of life without the public having any knowledge of the propagandistic initiative." Can we talk about some of the language we hear used by the Christian right and how it might perhaps be decoded to explain how this is really is something that is the best propaganda because it's sort of invisible?
Well, that is exactly how they do communicate. It is in code, and they're very effective at that. They cannibalize language, as all totalitarian movements do. You know, they take terms like liberty and twist it inside out so that it has a kind of newspeak quality, which Orwell would have understood. We all have a pretty sort of general notion of what liberty means, but liberty in this movement comes to mean liberty that comes when one submits completely to Jesus Christ, and of course that by implication is by those who claim to speak for Christ, by those who submit to those church figures who run this movement. That of course is not a form of liberty, it's a form of slavery, and the movement is shot through, so they're able to speak in the comforting language of traditional Christianity and American patriotism, but they've hollowed out the words to mean something else.
Well, American fascists appears to spring from your 2004 essay, which I'd found at theocracywatch.com. The website there noted that no major publication would print the article at that time. Did this sort of force your expansion into a book form?
Yes. A variation of that article was published in Harper's, but it didn't bear much resemblance to it. You know, many, many people are uncomfortable going on the assault against this movement. I think that they give this movement a religious legitimacy that it shouldn't have. And I think because I come out of a church tradition, I mean, not only did I graduate from seminary, but I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. Part of my writing, and certainly part of this book, comes from the anger at a tradition that formed me, shaped me, nurtured me, and that I value deeply at being sort of manipulated and used, you know, in very nefarious and dark ways. I mean, this movement speaks about acculturating American society with the Christian religion. But in fact, what they've done is acculturate the Christian religion with the worst aspects of American capitalism and American imperialism. And I think for those of us who value the church tradition and inform our lives through our faith, this movement is an anathema. I mean, not least of which is because it calls in the end for the achievement of secular power.
Well, you use the term dominionists to define those elements of fundamentalist Christians whose worldview is cause for worry. Who are the dominionists?
Well, dominionism, and you're really right to pick up on that term, because these are not traditional fundamentalists. They're not traditional evangelicals. I mean, traditional fundamentalists called on believers to remove themselves from the contaminants of secular society, to shun political involvement. Traditional evangelicals, people like Billy Graham, always warned followers about getting too close to political power. He himself came to Richard Nixon's defense during the Watergate scandal, something for which he has always expressed a great deal of regret. This is a new movement. This is a radical mutation. This calls for the creation of a Christian state, a Christian America. Now, we use terms like evangelical or fundamentalist to describe them, but they're something we've not seen on the American landscape, although we've had many religious revivals going all the way back to the Second Great Awakening of 1740. We've never seen anything like this. And these dominionists have fused the language and iconography of American Christianity with the language and iconography of American nationalism. And I covered conflicts such as the former Yugoslavia, where that kind of fusion leads to a very toxic and dangerous and intolerant political system.
Well, the Christian right seems obsessed with the Bible's alleged prophecies in the Book of Revelations. You are a divinity school graduate. Can you talk a little bit about this very strange part of the New Testament and how its already rather bizarre passages have been further altered into something like the Left Behind bestsellers?
All totalitarian movements, certainly fascist movements, embrace this notion of catastrophic violence as a way to purge or cleanse the earth and create the utopia, whether it's the Thousand-Year Reich or Fraternité, Égalité, Liberté, or the Second Coming of Jesus Christ or a workers' paradise. I mean, that's what totalitarian movements do. And so that embrace, and then the pornographic sort of depictions of violence that are very much part of this movement, at once thrill and terrify believers. The Left Behind series is a fascinating phenomenon. It has, of course, no biblical legitimacy at all. The word rapture never appears in the Bible. Most of the major constructs in this whole strange, violent eschatology are not biblically based at all. They're just creation after creation, fiction after fiction. But by sort of cobbling together some of the most questionable passages of the Bible, both from the Book of Revelation and the Book of Daniel, they have managed to kind of give a sacred authority to this frightening drive to perpetuate this notion that we are headed very soon towards the end of history in which, you know, all non-believers along with the earth will be eradicated and believers will be lifted up into heaven naked in this bizarre spiritual Darwinism. What this really is an expression of is a theology of despair. a notion that nothing in this world is worth saving, and that the greatest and most glorious moment in human history will come with the world's destruction. And when that is what you believe, then global warming doesn't matter, wars in the Middle East don't matter, terrible poverty and loss of jobs don't matter. I mean, in essence, the worse it gets, the closer you get to Armageddon, and the better it is. Now, I think this maximalist foreign policy comes that the Bush administration has adopted comes right out of the Christian right. The fact that, you know, this administration doesn't, in essence, engage in diplomacy. It speaks to the rest of the world almost exclusively in the language of violence. This administration has done nothing to restrain the hand of Israel. The situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis is the worst it has been in decades. I mean, I think probably one could argue since the inception of the conflict began with the creation of the Jewish state. The Christian right, which provides a radical and important segment of this administration's base, fervently embraces very childlike and simplistic vision that I think is translated into many of the actions of the administration itself, certainly with regards to how we view Islam. I mean, the kind of demonization of Islam and Muslim culture, and now that we've finished and stood by as the working class in this country has been abandoned and betrayed, we're seeing an assault on the middle class. Anything that can be put on software can be outsourced and is being outsourced, so that, you know, we are giving rise to an oligarchic state where we already live in a country where the top 1% control more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. That figure alone should terrify those who care about a democracy. And you can't sustain a democratic society with those kinds of injustices and inequities. That's not a new idea. It goes all the way back to Plutarch and Thucydides when they wrote about what kept Athenian democracy viable. And this rise of this mass political movement wrapped in the American flag and clutching the Christian cross is what we get for that deep mutation. And I think ultimately, if we want to blunt this movement, we as a society have to step up and reincorporate or reenfranchise these people who have been pushed aside back into the fold and blunt the rise of the corporate state. Otherwise, our democracy is doomed.
The book is American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. Our guest has been author Chris Hedges, former Mideast Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He teaches at the Program for American Studies at Princeton University. Chris Hedges, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.